Accession number 20519, Reel 1.
Trevor John, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in the village of Pencode, near Bridgend in South Wales.
Which year was this?
1931.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Pencode?
I lived in Pencode until about the age of four. My father was a miner and they'd opened a new colliery called the Cum near Pontypridd, between Llantrisant and Pontypridd in Glamorgan. So we moved to the village of Beddau, which is spelled B-E-D-D-A-U. Translated into English, it actually means graves. And the story has it that sheep stealers were hung near the crossroads there in the old days and buried nearby. It was a small village. There were just about six streets at the time, although over the years, of course, it's now virtually a suburb of Pontypridd.
What was it like in that area in the pre-war period?
It was nice, quiet village life, really. One of our hobbies at the time, because buses and cars were few and far between, I remember sitting on the doorstep of, we lived in a flat at the time above a village shop. I remember sitting on the doorstep with a pencil and paper, taking the numbers of the cars and buses, which just tells you how few there were compared to today. We roamed the countryside playing quite a bit. There didn't seem to be the concern about children wandering around in those days as now. It was quite a nice life for a young person, I think. Although, having said that, we weren't particularly well off, materially speaking, people and children seem to have a lot more nowadays than we had then. Books, toys were fairly few and far between.
What was your schooling like?
Well, when the war broke out, the last World War broke out, of course I was just 8 years of age. And in the junior school, I think a lot of the teachers had been called up. There were a few elderly teachers and some, a few younger ones. Things were in short supply. I was very keen on sport. I would play anything with a ball. Not so keen on the academic side. But nevertheless, I vividly remember sitting in the classroom with a teacher on a high desk out front with a large cane lying across the front there, as if to say, just behave yourself or else. And the other thing I vividly remember is playing football on days that were nice and dry, because we never had any football boots. We had black plimsolls for physical education, and we played football in our school shoes if it was nice and dry. So, you know, and of course, we didn't tend to have lots of sweets and chocolate. And especially during the war when the rationing was on.
Was there any bombing in your area?
We lived about, as the crow flies, probably about 6 miles from Cardiff. There was a bit of a mountain between the village and Cardiff. And I used to look out of my bedroom window watching the flashes of the Arcach fire. The guns firing at the aeroplanes as they were going over, and the bombs dropping in Cardiff. I vividly remember that. And the most exciting thing that happened really was a landmine attached to a parachute flying over the top of the village church and landing at the end of the street and making quite a massive crater. But fortunately, it didn't explode. My father was in the ARP at the time and used to travel down to Cardiff during these air raids to help dig out people from the rubble, you know, and work in general. What he did altogether, I don't really know, but I remember him vividly talking about pulling people out of the rubble, the buildings that had been bombed.
Did you take much of an interest in the course of the war?
Yes, I did. We used to listen to the radio and follow it through quite a lot. But I don't think that I fully appreciated the, the effect that the war was having on the general population and on ourselves. We were rather young, and I was probably more interested in going out and playing football. You know.
Was your schooling affected at all by the war?
Looking back, I would say. More certainly. Never thought about it at the time, of course, but I don't think that we had as much attention in school as perhaps we could have done to encourage us to follow various sort of follow various subjects and I suppose develop our talents. I don't think that was there all that much, and that's understandable, I think, because of the emphasis on the war itself, and lots of teachers inevitably going out to fight. But I was an academic myself, and I wasn't really concerned about it at the time. But looking back, yeah, I think it was a pretty austere time all around.
Any evacuee children moved into your school?
We had a lot of evacuees in the village. And we had moved from the flat into a new council house around about 1936, I would have thought. So when the war broke out, we were living in this three-bed house, and we had a mother and three children from Islington in London who were staying with us for quite a few years during the war. Her husband was in the army fighting away somewhere.
How did that work out?
Yeah, by and large, it worked out quite well, but inevitably we were rather crowded in the house, and I think occasionally we had our differences, but I think overall it was quite a happy situation.
Were your family obliged to take this evacuee family?
I was so young at the time that I don't think I was involved in any decision making, and I couldn't tell you. I think it was a good question of people being asked if they would take evacuees, but I don't know. Yeah.
Did most of the evacuee families come from London?
Certainly the ones that I can remember did, yes. Mm. All of them, as far as I know.
Did they seem to be different in any way from the local people?
Well, inevitably their accents were different, and we certainly picked that up. That apart, I think they tended to settle in quite well. I'm probably biased, but I think that the people in the village were, generally speaking, quite welcoming anyway. And easy to get on with. So.
Did you suffer any deprivation during the war in the way of food or other commodities?
Well, everything was rationed. We used to keep chickens in the backyard so that we had fresh eggs. And I remember at Christmas time, I mean, if we had chicken, that was quite a treat then. And beef tended to be a lot cheaper than it is today. We could afford, I think, beef then more easily than chicken. Margarine, sugar, sweets, they were all rationed. And I remember my mother with a coupon books, having to give coupons in exchange for these various food items.
From your own point of view, did you find the rationing irksome at all?
I think what you don't have, you don't tend to miss. And even though we had very few sweets and chocolate, no, I didn't. And I suppose looking back, I have read that our diet during the war was probably better than we have today. So it may well be something, it might have done me some good, so I'm pleased about that. I don't know. I can remember having the dried egg that came over from America, quite well. No, that was okay. I didn't mind that.
What was your address during the war?
We lived in a little cul-de-sac right opposite the village church, and it had number 13. The house was number 13, which a lot of people would say is an unlucky number. I've never thought of it to be unlucky. I lived there for years until I was in my early 20s. And it was 13 Llwyn Crwn Road, which was a nice Welsh name.
What does that
But
mean?
that I don't know because I'm not Welsh speaking and I never bothered to find out, to be honest with you. I should know. My wife might know, I'll have to ask her.
Were there any forces in your area during the war?
I remember on one occasion a lot of American soldiers turning up at the common just outside the village. It was in fact a common land which was for the Freemen of Llantrisant, the town nearby. And they had that land given them when they went to fight in Europe for, I can't quite remember the name of the king now, but they fought and had their own sort of regiment and went off to fight, and they were given this common land because of that centuries ago. The Americans came during the war, and for a week or so they were camping on the common land. It's actually the common land which is now adjacent to the mint where they make the currency. That's in Llantrisant in South Wales. We used to go down there as children to talk to the Americans, and in particular to try and get some chewing gum off them, which we had from time to time.
How did the American soldiers behave?
They were okay as far as I know. I do remember that one or two of them were seen out with the local village girls, but I never paid too much attention to that at my age. But they were fine. We did. I can't remember any major problems arising there.
Any POWs in your area?
No, the nearest POW camp, as far as I know, was in Bridgend in South Wales. I actually went past that on one occasion, but that was well after the war when it was basically a derelict site. But we did know that there was a POW camp at Bridgend. But of course, that was much nearer to the village where I was born. And it was around probably 8 to 9 miles from where I lived, during the war.
For what nationality of POW was that?
I was given to understand they were German.
Any celebrations at the end of the war?
Oh yes, yeah. The village of Beda was on the high ground, and just about half a mile away at the most was the village of Tinant. And at the end of the World War, there we had a bonfire which was massive, really. They had sort of dozens and dozens of railway sleepers, and at the end of one of the streets everybody congregated, and we had I remember it was a very exciting evening for, you know, one so young. Well, I wasn't so young then, of course. When the war finished, I would have been 14.
So the bonfire was at Tinant?
Yes, yeah, which is, you know, right next door to Beda. And near, not too far from the colliery. And of course, most of the people living around there were miners anyway. Most of the men were miners. So we had a right big bonfire, and we had street parties as well.
Had you listened to wireless much during the war?
Yeah, I quite enjoyed listening to the radio, because I can remember being allowed to stay up to listen to, this is just before the war, listen to Tommy Farr, the boxer fighting Joe Louise in America. And that stuck in my mind. But I certainly remember the broadcasts by Winston Churchill in the war, and following quite closely, I think probably the latter part of the war more so, because I was a little bit older then, but following quite closely the events on day-to-day basis.
Did you ever listen to Ho-Ho?
Yes, yeah. I think we picked him up on the radio once or twice, but I can't really remember much about the content. On the other hand, it might well be that I remember him because I heard so much about him during the war, you know.
Can you tell me about when you finished secondary school, please?
Yeah, I finished at the age of 14. Never sat my 11 plus, so I never went to grammar school. I wasn't thought to be bright enough really for that, so my head teacher told me, which is I think a shame, but there you are. We weren't a well-off family financially. By this time my father had pneumoconiosis, which was a common thing for miners, and left the colliery. Was working for a local authority, just doing hedge cutting and tidying up the verges around the countryside. Wasn't earning a lot of money. And I went to work in a brewery, bottling beer for £3 a week, which was a lot of money in those days, you know, straight after the war. But I only did that for 12 months, and decided I wanted to be a craftsman. In fact, I really wanted to be a carpenter, but I couldn't get an apprenticeship as a carpenter. So I, after making inquiries at the, what's now known as the job centre, I ended up having an interview at Cardiff for a building apprenticeship. And I remember opposite the Angel Hotel in Cardiff, there's of course the Cardiff Arms Park rugby ground. And just outside was the Department of Employment building. Can't remember what they called it really now, but it was a job centre. I went there for interview, and I remember being in a fairly long room with lots of other youngsters, And by this time, I decided I couldn't be a carpenter. I'd have a go at brickwork. So I remember a bloke of that fella standing out in front of all of us and saying, "Would you get in one long line?" Which we did. And then he said, "Everyone who would like to be a bricklayer, hold your hands out." And with that, with the palms up. So we held our hands out with our palms up, and he went along the line and said things like, "Yes, you're okay." And going to the next one would perhaps say, "I'm sorry, but your hands are too small." So he was very practical about selecting bricklaying apprentices. I don't think he was interested in what intelligence you had, but just about the size of your hands. I was quite bemused about that anyway. I ended up being an apprentice with a firm that had been in Cardiff for many years called Turners. And I stayed there with them for probably about 2 years on building projects in Cardiff before having my indentures transferred to what was known as Llantrisant and Llantwit Vadra Rural District Council, where I went on a direct labour force with the council. I finished my apprenticeship with those after 5 years, having a deferment from my national service, which was 18 years of age then, of course. But because of my apprenticeship, I was deferred and finished my apprenticeship just after 20 years of age. Remember vividly having my first full pay as a craftsman and being ever so pleased. But my joy sort of diminished somewhat when the following morning I had my calling up papers from the National Service. So I just had, you know, 1 week's full wages before I had my call up papers.
Yeah. What did Cardiff look like at the end of the Second World War?
I think the dock area had most of the bombing, and I don't really know what it was like other than my father telling me about the buildings being demolished, because I never went there. We never travelled far afield from the village in those days. So I do remember Cardiff City Centre, going to the job centre and all that, and travelling from there out to what used to be the old Cardiff Airport, Pengham and Tremorva. That didn't seem too bad. I didn't really see a lot of damage there, but I think most of it was dock area, you know.
What happened once you got your call-up papers, please?
I had to report to Maindy Barracks in Cardiff, and that was in December 1951. We did 6 weeks basic training at Maindy Barracks. It was mainly what they call square bashing, building up our level of fitness, although I must admit I was fairly fit because of my involvement in sport. At the time, I was very keen on football and what have you. So I thought I was pretty fit at the time. I remember the only rifle that we fired was on a miniature range at the rear of the camp, on a 2-02 range of 2-02 rifles. But that was it. After 6 weeks, we were transferred to Derrin Lines in Brecon.
How had you been treated in the basic training by the people in charge?
I think the army worked on the basis that you needed to follow orders. I didn't feel, looking back now, I never thought about it too much at the time, but looking back, I'm quite convinced that they were trying to get everybody in a situation where no matter what the order was, you followed it through. And I can understand that to a degree, but I do believe that they probably lost out and would have benefited by asking people their views in certain situations. And there's probably too much of an emphasis on square bashing and getting fit and not looking at what could have been realistic warfare situations and talking them through. And the reason I say that is because of my own experiences that were to follow. You know, never thought about it much at the time, but I certainly think that now.
Yeah. You said you went to Brecon afterwards?
We spent 10 weeks continuation training in Brecon. I can't remember his name, but I remember having sort of a sergeant in charge of our platoon who was rather short and quite nasty as far as I was concerned. Didn't really like him all that much, and I thought the feeling was probably mutual, I don't know why. But I remember going on a platoon march one day. We'd been issued with 303 rifles. I didn't really know anything about guns and rifle 303 rifles. But when we were marching along, I can't remember how long the march was, but it was probably 3 or 4 miles or maybe a bit more. We had the rifles slung over our shoulders. And unknown to me, I had a faulty catch on the bolt of the rifle, which meant that as I was walking along, the bolt fell out. Unfortunately, it was picked up, but it was picked up by a corporal, a lad who'd gone into Khomeini Barracks, Cardiff, at the same time as ourselves, and had been made up to a lance corporal. He picked up the bolt and promptly gave it to the sergeant rather than asking who it belonged to. And I had, a week during the evenings after training, peeling potatoes in the camp, which I didn't really appreciate all that much. I can remember, again, the emphasis was on getting fit. And we did things like going over the assault course. Wasn't my lucky camp, really, because at the assault course, the last obstacle was a rope swing over a large rectangular pond. And the rope hung from a large wooden pole coming over the pond at an angle. And it was my turn to swing over. The rope had been thrown back to me. I swung over, and halfway across, the pole broke, and I went in the water with all my kit and my rifle. And for anyone who knows what it's like doing training in the army, you'd know that you needed to keep your kit in A1 condition. So much so that we had kit inspection every morning, and we would probably stay up very often half the night cleaning our brasses. And I can remember laying our kit out on the beds and sleeping under the bed during the night so that it would all be ready for inspection the following morning, which is a bit of a stupid situation, really, but it happened. Anyway, I didn't really have much luck on the assault course, and I spent a lot of time cleaning my kit up after that, as you can imagine. I can remember going on runs during the training period. I can remember going up into the mountains where they had another obstacle course. And we were told that the first one to complete the obstacle course would have a weekend pass to go home. So I was quite keen on this and thought, well, I'd try and get to the front. But unfortunately, the sergeant had decided that the lance corporals would be at front, followed by the privates. And the first obstacle was a rope crossing, which you, where you could only go one at a time. So the people at the front obviously had a big advantage. I didn't get a weekend pass. But I do remember the last obstacle was jumping over a mountain stream. And by the time you got there, you were so tired. And I'm talking about February.